watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Rural America is known for sending its children to the military to fight for a vision of America, one that doesn't quite exist. They believe their government when it tells them they must fight communists in tiny country X or terrorists in impoverished country Z. Ironically, these soldiers from rural America have more in common with the insurrectionary third world villagers they're fighting than they realize. Both live in places that are being beaten down for the sake of a corporate bottom line somewhere. Our defenders of American democracy find out just how little democracy they have when they try to stop a corporation from ruining their hometown. A new populist alliance of longtime environmental activists and rural folk in central Pennsylvania has grown out of a struggle to ban toxic agribusiness operations that have targeted the area as the next profit opportunity. This movement is taking a new approach that is spreading across America via a project of public education and organization called Democracy Schools that are teaching direct action lawmaking to challenge corporate supremacy and to create rights under law for people and the land. Last fall, I attended a democracy school here in the Finger Lakes and broadcast some recordings from it. People from the course, which was sponsored by the Finger Lakes Progressive Group, were so inspired they decided to organize a series of democracy schools around New York State. The second New York democracy school took place near Binghamton last month. I went to interview the lead instructors and founders, Tom Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, based in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and Richard Grossman, a longtime activist and prime mover behind the Project on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, POCLAD, that identified the issue of corporate rights as the primary obstacle to realizing the American democracy we are told we have. I began by asking Richard Grossman what led to the founding of the democracy schools.
Starting 12 years ago, 13 years ago, some folks, including myself, began to look into the history and nature of corporations because we felt we had hit a wall, that the organizing that so many of us had been involved in and trying to stop what seemed to be endless corporate assaults with government assistance or government assaults with corporate assistance on communities and people's rights wasn't getting anywhere. I mean, we weren't at the end of the 1980s when I got together with colleagues and friends of mine that I've been working with over the previous quarter century. We found ourselves complaining that this is not where we thought we would be 25 years before. And so in a sort of logical fashion, we began to ask why instead of just whining about it. And one of the things that kept coming up is that we began to realize, what should have been obvious, is that so many of the struggles we had been involved in had ended up at corporate boardroom doors or at government regulatory agencies or in courts and legislatures, which were in fact siding with the corporations and against the communities, against people, against the earth. And we realized we didn't know much at all about the history of corporations, where they came from, you know, how all this came about. And so, in my case, with a guy named Frank Adams, we began to do some research, and in 1993 we published a little pamphlet called Taking Care of Business, Citizenship and the Charter of Incorporation. And that generated quite a response, and in order to sort of deal with that response, we began holding meetings around the country, informal meetings that we called Rethinking the Corporation, Rethinking Democracy, And over the course of the next couple of years, we did several hundred of these meetings. And out of those meetings came were people who wanted to pursue this work. And out of that came the organization, Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, POCLA, that formed with a friend of mine, Ward Morehouse. And so we kept doing that work. Meanwhile, Tom Lindsay had graduated from law school, and he set up something called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund in 1995 in Pennsylvania. And we found each other and started to engage Tom in this sort of growing conversation of mostly older people regarding the work that we all have been doing for 25 and 30 years and the need to rethink the work. To sort of make a long story short, the work within a couple of years, by the end of the 1990s, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund in Pennsylvania began to change the nature of the work. By cooperating with municipalities to move away from the regulatory system, stop using the zoning boards and planning boards and the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the whole permitting system, because we had begun to understand that that's a system for legalizing harm and denying people rights. And he began working with communities, municipalities, passing laws that actually banned certain corporate operations and began to strip corporations of their claims to the Constitution, to constitutional rights and powers. That started happening in dozens and dozens and dozens of municipalities in Pennsylvania over the last 4 or 5 years. As that started happening, people from Pennsylvania, other parts of Pennsylvania and from around the country began to call and start asking us what's going on. They explained, and we found ourselves on the phone having 2 and 3 hour conversations with people, which was very time consuming. And finally, as we were whining about that, one of the people who called said to us, why don't you start a school and actually start showing people what's going on here? And so out of that, we said, okay. And because why a school of this nature and structure, where basically people come and sit around in a circle and go through a curriculum that's half history, some hidden histories of this country, history of corporations, history of the Constitution, the founding of the country, people's movements, and stuff like that. Sit around circles. We spend half the time doing that and half the time exploring the actual struggle, the work that's going on in Pennsylvania. So there's a historical view and an empirical view of what actually how the work is changing. We got some of that model from the Highlander Center, Tennessee, which is a people's folk school, which was founded in the 1920s to help teach people to work, to organize union organizing, civil rights organizing, anti-toxic organizing. Frank Adams turns out was the director at Highlander in the 1960s when the state of Tennessee revoked their charter for having integrated classes and shut down the school. In the 1980s, I had got involved in Highlander to help start what we call the Stop the Poisoning SDP schools. So I had been exposed to some of that teaching in Highlander where they sit around in rocking chairs. Long story, we took little bits from each of those traditions, added our own curriculum, and started doing these schools. We've now done, this is the 79th school. We've graduated 1,000 people or so. There's going to be 5 more of these schools in New York State in this year. Other states are doing similar things. We're going to do about 40, 50 schools around the country this year. And so it's a way of replicating what we think we've learned, getting more people involved. We've had to train other people to be trainers because we cannot do all the schools. And so partly what's happening at this school is there are 2 New York people here who are acting as third and fourth chair who will be, in the future schools, be teaching the schools themselves so that we're replicating the schools as much as possible.
As this thing is maturing, what is happening?
It's interesting because for the past 5 years, these municipal governments in probably the unlikeliest of places, the unlikeliest of folks, first-time activists, these are the folks with the John Deere hats and the steel-toed boots and folks that make a living generally out of clearing roads in the wintertime, patching them in the summertime, that work with those communities has resulted in close to 100 municipalities now in Pennsylvania who have adopted laws banning agribusiness and sludge corporations from doing business in those communities.
Tom Lindsay.
And that's about 10% of the rural municipal governments in Pennsylvania. So it's safe to say that there's a small rebellion underway at this point in time of municipalities who are refusing in many ways to obey some facets of state laws that have been drafted, engineered by the agribusiness and sludge corporations specifically to keep those municipalities contained. In other words, to strip their power away from being able to say no to corporate factory farms and sludge coming in. The work has evolved over the past 2 years in significant new ways. We're no longer happy, and in fact, some of our municipalities have decided to move in a different direction as well that makes them happier, which is to take the ordinance work, which is basically about defining sustainable communities by default. In other words, saying what's not in them. In other words, we define a sustainable community as one that doesn't contain a corporate factory farm and one that doesn't have land applied sludge coming in, that some of these municipalities are now experimenting with writing their own constitutions at the local level. In other words, a concept called home rule, which 43 states have some degree of home rule, but essentially it allows citizens within a community to rewrite their municipal charter, to expand the authority that they have at the municipal level to pass laws. And whether those are the anti-corporate farming laws, whether they're about the rights of nature, which is this exciting new idea that's starting to blossom, starting to pick up some steam in Pennsylvania, or whether it's about expanding the rights of communities and people who live within those communities, that the home rule stuff is akin to constitution making. So folks are starting to move from passing ordinances on single issues to essentially shifting into rewriting the structure of governance under which they live in that community. And the first two communities went through the home rule process last year in 2005. And so communities are starting to experiment with new ways to be disobedient, in some ways to be comprehensively more disobedient, to say we are going to reject various aspects of state law and various aspects of laws written illegitimately by agribusiness and sludge companies, but we're going to move into making our own constitutions at the local level. And so we're really driving towards a fundamental confrontation between the U.S. constitutional framework, which essentially has been wrapped around corporations as to make illegitimate laws via those powers, and local constitutions that are being written about a community rights and nature constitution. So at the federal level, we have a property and commerce constitution that protects and, in effect, enables corporations to override what communities do. While in these communities, they're starting to draft rights and nature constitutions, and it's setting up the big battle, which is about who's going to define what communities look like over the next 50, 100 years, if we're around that long.
Who will have the ability or the authority to make law that reflects their particular values, to turn their values into public policy? So if we say we live in a corporate state, which Tom and I say we live in now, and so that the dominant values are corporate values, the dominant value of endless more, they define what efficiency is, they define what productivity is, what the best thing to do. So that, for example, the best example of efficiency is an industrial agriculture system where a handful of people produce all the stuff that they actually call food, they dare to call food. People in rural communities with family farms and a different social structure, A, don't think that that's food, and B, don't think that's that's an appropriate system to have the fewest people possible produce the most possible food with all the chemicals and fossil fuels and all that. And so, unfortunately, right now and over the past 100 and X years, the whole structure of law and constitutional interpretation and constitution writing has been to privilege those values, to turn the corporate values into law and policy. And so what comes out of these democracy schools is people beginning to see that, in fact, if they want to have different kinds of communities based on sustainability and equity, equitable relationships, fairness, justice, they want to have justice, you can't get there from here under this constitutional structure, under this accumulation of law and culture, which empowers a few people running giant corporations to basically turn their values into law. And so that the strategy has to be to run right at that and not try to make the corporate structure a little less bad and make the food a little less polluted and poisoned, to make the air a little less bad. How do you run right at that and define in our communities? We won't allow that happening in our communities at all.
I'm interested in how the confrontation plays out.
Well, let's talk first about how the efforts are spreading outside of Pennsylvania. In other words, up till now it's been a Pennsylvania phenomenon in some ways, but it's starting to spread outside. Just a couple weeks ago, a small town in New Hampshire became the first to strip corporations of constitutional rights at the municipal level. and also the first to ban corporations from withdrawing water within the community.
Uh-huh. Which was that town?
It was Barnstead, New Hampshire. Uh-huh. And so the and only after they went through democracy schools and people from Barnstead came to democracy schools and then decided to do the organizing in a different way. So the stuff doesn't just sprout up arbitrarily. It's actually something that folks have to think about how to do the organizing differently. And then at this town meeting, it passed 136-1, the ordinance that did this work. In Pennsylvania, last year, we took two communities, worked with two communities, to go through the home rule process in terms of getting the referendum initiative on the ballot. And they failed in both places, mainly because the corporate boys came out full force to try to defeat them. In one location, about 12,000 people in the community, we lost by a swing of about 150 votes. So it was very close. The home rule charters, we've drafted a model that's being used by some of the communities that are interested in going through this process. And that model contains a bunch of different things, including the rights of nature. This concept that natural systems, ecosystems, have rights independently of people, right to exist. And so that's being written into these home rule charters in our model, as well as the anti-corporate farming and all the other ordinances that we've been working on that essentially constitutionalizes those ordinances into these local constitutions. And it's a much more comprehensive way to begin building the types of communities that, that folks want, unrestrained by this constitutional structure that beats it out of them.
How has corporate America been responding to these various ordinances? And have they tried to challenge these things in court or what, bribe elected officials or have people assassinated? How are they responding?
Well, unfortunately, in the system, they don't need to bribe anybody because most of the officials with preemptive power are already working for them or are them in many ways. And so they've used, to come after our ordinances, they've used the three conventional routes. One is the courts. So we're in litigation over one of our anti-corporate farming laws now. We just got a positive ruling at the end of last year on that ordinance. In the legislature, we fought them back for 5 years to preempt some of these ordinances. A law was passed last year, finally, under a liberal Democratic governor, Ed Rendell, who essentially screwed us over worse than the Republican administration that came before him, to sic the Attorney General on these local rural governments to sue them to overturn local ordinances. So it's like the body, the state body eating itself, because now the Attorney General is authorized to sue township governments to overturn ordinances.
Is the Attorney General doing that?
First 14 letters went out from the Attorney General's office a couple weeks ago, threatening to sue these townships unless they repeal their ordinances. And these are zoning ordinances, these are regulatory ordinances, and they are our anti-corporate farming laws as well. So becoming very active to knock these things down. And to the credit of most of the township governments we work with, they're standing tough. They're saying this is crazy, that now our own state is turning against us in worse ways than they had before, because now it's out in the open that here's a state official who's charged with suing us. And so now the townships have to fight the state. That's in essence what's happening. But it also shows, it illustrates the picture very clearly, that the problem is not necessarily corporations. The problem is that we live in a corporate state where the corporations and the people that run them, the small handful of people that actually run the corporations, are able to use the state apparatus, including the law and the Attorney General and the state officials, to come after those units of government to overturn them. Who dare to challenge the corporations and the work that the corporations want to do within those townships. So there's a fascinating story unfolding in Pennsylvania. In essence, to take these townships out, they're now having to use the state apparatus to do it. And it really shows people who's in control, that our governmental institutions we don't control, and that our governmental institutions are used against us and against values that communities have on the ground who want to put them into law.
Because the essential message from the state government politicians, from legislators who ended up supporting this preemptive bill, and from the courts, is, except for this one case so far, is they basically turn to the community and say, you have no right to make this law. You have no authority to trample upon the constitutional powers and authorities of these corporations. You're not in control. And when most people hear that, who've been involved in a campaign in their communities to pass laws, that adds fuel to the fire. I mean, those are fighting words. and they want to take the next step because they begin to really rethink their notion of U.S. history and of the beautiful July 4th words about all and reflected in the state constitutions that all political power is in the hands of the people and that, you know, we're self-governing people, we make the rules. And so when a legislator or the newspaper editor, publisher, or the judges come in and say, you have no right to pass this law that says no corporate factory farm or no corporate sludge or no corporate water withdrawal, that's fuel to the fire. And what the work in the democracy schools does, and our work in general, is to help people anticipate that this is going to happen. So, in fact, it comes as no surprise. People don't cower in the corner. They're expecting it, and they welcome it, because it's an essential next step in sort of ratcheting up the organizing to go more frontally at, in fact, not the corporate leaders, but the government officials and the accumulation of law that has given the few people running corporations way, way more governing power than our own people in our own communities.
What can they do if the municipality says, we don't care what you say, we're not allowing corporate factory farms in our municipality?
It's a very good question, because it comes down to how obedient people are. In other words, in Pennsylvania, the attorney general will take the municipality to court. They'll sue the township. It won't sue them for damages or anything else, because it's the state suing, and that's not part of state suits. But what they'll seek is a court order from the Commonwealth Court, or which we have in Pennsylvania, or Pennsylvania Supreme Court, that orders the municipality or nullifies the ordinance is what the court order would do. And then the question is, does the municipality follow that court order? I mean, it's a very dicey thing, because the fact is the law that was written is illegitimate. It was written by the corporate folks specifically to stop people at the community level from deciding what type of agriculture or farming that they want. In other words, the corporate folks are defining the type of farming, and that preempts or overrides the vision that the community has for what type of agriculture that they want. So it's an illegitimate law being used by a minority of people to override a vision by a community majority. So it's an illegitimate law, which means that the court order is illegitimate as well. And in fact, it's unjust and all those other terms that apply to it. So the question is, how badly do we want to build the types of communities that we want and need? And how disobedient are we prepared to be to build those communities? That's the question.
And the communities also face the threat of the corporation suing. And they can sue for real money. I mean, they can sue for damages, they can sue for lost profits, they can sue to have the communities, if the corporations win, to pay the legal fees for the corporations, which can get quite hefty over a number of years. And, you know, the threatening in the end, if they win, to put a community into receivership so that, in fact, representatives of the corporation, they'll be state people, but they'll be running the community. That's a real messy situation that could come into play. And the same question that Tom asks holds here. Are people willing to risk that and to in fact use that as a provocation to ratchet up their organizing and ratchet up their aspirations? Because I think as people in communities particularly begin to experience firsthand the long arm of the state, I mean, excuse the cliche, but you know, the state has to protect its structure, and it's not going to allow any of these ordinances to stand if it possibly can. And this organizing model welcomes that, because we want, it's very important that people see that it's not so much the directives of corporations, that it's the government themselves, which is the same thing in a sense, that they are doing the heavy lifting for the corporation, that they're bringing the law into play, they're bringing, in the end, you know, let's say a community, a township, has no anti-corporate farming law, and the state tries to nullify it, and the community stays with it, and the corporation tries to locate a farm, and they have the land, and one day they bring in their bulldozers and their construction stuff, and it's coming in, and the township sends out its sheriff and says, I'm sorry, but the law here says you cannot do this. And the corporation then calls the state police. And the state police comes and says to the sheriff, they're going in. That's a very crucial and delicate confrontation, which...
Has that happened? Actually happened?
It's happened not in Pennsylvania and not at that scale, but there have been, historically in this country, there have been situations like that. It could happen, say, with the nuclear waste dump in Nevada.
It's happened in New York, in Allegheny County, where they blockaded the roads, and the state police were brought in, and the people said no. They blockaded the roads to keep a low-level radioactive site out, and specifically the New York Siting Commission out of Allegheny County. They blockaded all the roads, and state police were brought in. They arrested 30, 40 people, and they still refused to move. And then they brought the horses out, and they charged the state police. I mean, you know, so disobedience comes in waves, and it's in different places when people feel threatened. But using the state apparatus for those types of illegitimate decisions, it's time for people to disobey because this place is getting worse. I mean,
there's also it's a sort of a serious change in characterization, escalation, when instead of, you know, people trade in their community group, the little civic group, you know, citizens against such and such or citizens for such and such, as their organizing vehicle, and when the municipality becomes their organizing vehicle, and the municipality passes a law, the municipality has money raising capacity, it has lawmaking capacity, it has a sheriff, it has a legal enforcement apparatus. And when increasingly, you know, when 100, 500, 2,000, 5,000 municipalities around the country begin to go that route and say, we are not allowing this to happen here, and we're putting our wealth such as it is, and we're ordering our sheriff to enforce the law, that will create confrontations which will be very interesting. What we have now is communities all over the country, say, passing, there's several hundred communities that have passed resolutions against the Patriot Act, passed resolutions against GMO seeds, passed resolutions saying this is a nuclear-free zone. None of those trigger this stuff because they're not actionable. They're just a wish fulfillment in a way. When those resolutions begin becoming laws, the whole dynamic changes. It forces the state to react. That forces people to react. And it really changes the nature of the situation. To a place where it has to be dealt with, and this organizing is looking to those kinds of confrontations, so that people will have to choose basically which side that they're on.
All these people in these municipalities have people who, in the state legislature, who are purported to represent them. What's going on that level?
Well, there's actually been a couple of Republican legislators who have stood up for these communities and tried to introduce legislation. Legislation eventually failed because rural Pennsylvania gets trumped on daily because they don't have the political power. The political power is in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And so when you run for governor, you don't campaign through rural Pennsylvania because you don't need them. They're politically just a sacrifice zone. And so you win Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, you win the governorship or any other state office. And so the political power is lacking in some ways. What's fascinating about Pennsylvania is that the legislators gave themselves a pay raise about, 8 years ago or something, and we sued the legislature. We sued the state over the pay raise being unconstitutional, and nobody seemed to care. It was, you know, we were in court, and getting people to care about the pay raise was, like, impossible. And then last year, the legislature in Pennsylvania voted themselves a pay raise, and there was a revolt across Pennsylvania. And it actually resulted in the throwing out of one of the judges, state judges, that was up for not quite re-election, but the retainment is retainment elections we have in Pennsylvania. So they ask you, do you want to keep the judge or not? Well, in the history of those elections, no judge has ever lost because they're retainment elections. Last year, one of the judges got kicked out of office, didn't get the votes to be retained as a judge. And so the pay raise stuff is now combining with some of this local control anger. The local control is being stripped away from communities. And it's very interesting because they're almost every incumbent running for office this time around has a challenger. And how deep that goes is always a question. But the fact that it drew a response this time around, but not 8 years ago or 6 or 8 years ago, whenever the pay raise was, tells me that there's something happening in Pennsylvania. The groundwork has been laid by some of these very angry people who are watching the state government strip away their rights. And this was just one that just put the thing over the top, I think, in Pennsylvania.
But also, the values of this that are propagated and induced constantly and reinforced by this corporate culture are exceedingly powerful. And so you know, what we saw clearly when we were lobbying a lot in the legislature around these various nullification laws over the last couple of years, and talking to the assemblymen and legislators, and you know, it's not that they were in the pay of corporations or they were getting big contributions, for the most part, that they really believed that industrial corporate agriculture was the only path. I mean, we had senators say to us, "It's a done deal. There's nothing. I'm only a senator. What can I do? You know, it's the market. It's the trend. It's the this or the that. There's nothing we can do. It's the most efficient way. And yes, there's some problems, and we'll try to deal with the problems. But it's the only way. We can't go back to the day of factory farm, family farms, and all that."
Do you have family farmers in that area still that are at the center of this fight?
Yes, in quite a few of the municipalities, the elected officials are actually farmers. And in most places in rural Pennsylvania, just like rural everywhere, is you have farmers hanging by a thread, essentially relying on milk checks for the dairy operation that they run, or struggling to find other ways to stay in agriculture, like their wife or, in fact, another family member is taking a job off the farm to get health insurance and those types of things. These are not good times for farming. Especially family farmers, and I think that's one of the reasons why the revolt. They understand that, you know, here's these corporations getting millions of dollars in federal subsidies, and yet you have farm families trying to struggle just to get through with their next milk check that comes in. And so you have that happening in Pennsylvania, but you also have a strong drive towards a different type of agriculture, sustainable agriculture, that more and more people in Pennsylvania are beginning to engage in, and that's a healthy trend, I think. But at the same time, you got to dismantle the corporate ag system, because otherwise building markets won't do Shinola. Because, for example, the USDA now has a plan, this National Animal Identification System, NAIS, which would require microchips to be placed in all animals, all livestock, even for small family farmers. And so it's imposing additional costs once this thing goes into play. And family farmers are saying, well, wait a minute. This, you know, the mad cow stuff and all this is created by unsustainable ag practices, and now we're having to shell out. In fact, it may put us under because the profit margin is so thin on existing farms that to require us to put microchips in our animals so that the livestock can be tracked is just insane, both from a cost but also from a principal perspective of who's getting the benefit of the state regulation, who's getting the benefit of the subsidies and those types of things.
Also, it's not just, we're not just talking about agribusiness and agribusiness corporations, and particularly in a state like Pennsylvania, which had been an exceedingly industrial state, and it's a very rural state. There's plenty of open land. You go up into Schuylkill County, for example, west of Philadelphia. We had a one-day democracy school there a month ago or so. And you had 20 people sitting around the table, and they start telling their stories. You know, these three people are in a group, and they're fighting an oil coal to diesel fuel conversion thing coming in that is being subsidized by the federal government. These people are fighting a toxic dump. These people are fighting sewage sludge coming in being dumped in the old mines. Other people are fighting, you know, God knows what else. And you can go not just all over Pennsylvania, but pretty much all over the country. You go to rural areas, you find, you know, this endless list of corporate assaults enabled by government. And it has put people in an exceedingly defensive situation. And they're always saying no to something and trying to keep it out or make it a little less bad. I think there's a real a yearning in people's hearts and an increasing understanding that they can't keep playing defense. And they want to go on the offense. They want to begin, if they're going to be doing all this work of organizing and educating and agitating and mobilizing, they want to be doing that for the kind of community they want. They want to be doing it around positive stuff. And say, we have a vision for this community. We want a just community and fair. We want to be sustainable. We don't want to be dumped on. We don't want to be destroying our own infrastructure, you know, our own nest. We want to create jobs. We want to have a decent standard of living. We'll never get to that if we're always saying no to this and no to that, if the assaults keep coming. So that there's an evolution here, people sort of going from a very specific defensive campaign evolving into a bigger picture and saying, we want to tap into some of the best principles of this country about democratic self-governance. And we want to start making the rules. And we want to start using taxpayer money, municipal resources, to put our visions into play. And not always to say, well, maybe the best we can do is to let this corporation come and rape and ruin and try to make it a little less bad. And that's one of the reasons we spend a lot of time on people's movements in the democracy schools. And as we say often about the abolitionist movement, it took a while for it to congeal and to people to get clear what they wanted, to understand exactly what slavery was, a fundamental denial of rights written into the Constitution. But the abolitionists didn't seek a slave protection agency. They didn't try to make slavery a little less bad, although that would have certainly helped a lot of people. They said the proper course here, slavery is both morally wrong and it's a subversion of the fundamental values that many people had in this country, not the founding fathers particularly. They were the slave advocates. And so we have to change the Constitution. We have to build a movement strong enough so that when the opportunity is there, we can drive amendments into the Constitution that fundamentally change a slave and empire constitution into a rights and liberty constitution. And they did that through the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments after the Civil War. And then we go through the history here about how 10 and 15 years later, the Supreme Court and the federal courts cut the knees off these amendments and wrapped them around the corporations. People learn that history, and they realize that no victory is ever complete. But in fact, the process that has to take place here is that these defensive struggles have to turn into offensive struggles, where we really run right at the problem, as if we were Karl Rove. He knows how to run right at the problem. He doesn't shirk around. And we have to go after the fundamental law that has been written by a relatively few people that enables the few people in every generation to make the rules. And that's scary stuff. It's scary stuff for people to get a handle on. And we're all just learning how to do that kind of organizing.
Do you have any thoughts as to why so many people consistently allow themselves to be bullied by so few?
It's a very central question. You know, we start early on in the democracy schools. We start at about 1600 with the enclosure movement in England. And the very first headline from the selection we have from a book called The Many-Headed Hydra talks about the extraordinary violence that the monarchy, noble class, this 5% of the people, sort of used on the 95% or anybody that got out of line, and how it was all legal. There was not just the pillory and whippings and burnings and hangings and drawing and quartering. I mean, just an endless list of stuff. So it really, to speak out in those days or to break the rules, the monarchy, the kingdom came down with horrendous stuff. That violence has always been true. It's true in this country. It's maybe truer for people of color than for white people. But when there's real stuff happening in terms of large numbers of people approaching critical mass that are challenging some of the fundamentals, the corporate state does not have a reluctance to come down and use massive violence. In Pennsylvania, we've been looking into the history of the coal and iron police, that during the heavy years of union organizing, coal miners and steel workers, and the end of this 19th century into the beginning of the 20th century, the corporations got a law passed where the state set up a private police for the coal and iron operators, subsidized by the state government, where they had state authority. They acted in the name of the state. They wore badges. If one of the coal and iron police was hassling you and you resisted, you're resisting an officer. So that they got the law on their side. And they wrought an incredible amount of violence upon union members, with infiltration and pure violence and all that. I mean, the history of this country against African Americans, against white workers trying to organize, against Native Americans, against union people, against sort of any organized set of people trying to challenge the status quo, there's been an enormous amount of violence. In addition to which, the culture keeps reinforcing all the good, the so-called good stuff, that this is the most democratic country in the world, that everything is good, helping people to deny their own experience. One of the things we learn from the schools here, we go around the circle and people tell their stories of the kinds of struggles they've been in, and there's a kind of diffidence, a shyness about really reflecting their experience as valid. I mean, it takes other people helping to certify that, I went through the same thing in my community, and I went through the same thing in my community. It's as if the whole culture is cracking down to say what you think you've seen and experienced with your own eyes and ears, it's really not true, or it's your fault because you did it wrong and all that. And it's not really something structural. It's not something that had to happen. So I think some combination of the accumulation of the law, the strength of the culture, always persisting, and the use of violence make it very difficult for people to stand up. When people stand up, there's usually a price to pay. And there's only sort of moments in history when there's a social movement when people give each other the courage and create what Lawrence Goodwin said, the psychological space to dare to aspire grandly, talking about the populace in the 1890s. There's only moments in history where the right things come together. I mean, it certainly happened in the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s in this country, that was a moment where people took enormous risks and a lot of people lost their lives, a lot of people were beaten up, but it didn't seem to slow things down. In fact, every time somebody was killed or there was a police riot, in Birmingham, Alabama, more African Americans and some whites came out to join the struggle. And it seems, historically, to get a movement going like that takes generations of work, and you never know when it's actually going to congeal. And it's that movement that gives people the courage to stand up. It's very difficult to stand up alone. And even if you do, one person can't do all that much.
And how do you feel at this point in time? What would you, if you took the pulse of the nation, what do you feel is the situation?
I think in some ways it's desperation. I think, millions of people turned out in the streets to stop the Iraq war from happening or to end it, and how easy it was for this administration to take this country to war, how easy it was to do that. And so I think people are feeling a sense of desperation because in addition to that, after 40 years of doing organizing, after 40 years of appealing permits and getting community groups together and thousands of community groups coming together and doing work, that things are worse now than they ever have been. From an environmental perspective, by every major environmental statistic, things are worse today than they were 40 years ago. So you would think at the very least we would have stopped things from getting worse, maybe not made things better, but things have been degrading and being destroyed at a more rapid rate. And so I think there's a sense of desperation and frustration that's growing because there's only so many years that you can tell people buy the right things, go out and buy green, all very important things, buy recycled paper and stuff like that, but to represent that that's going to change things around is crazy. And I think people are starting to look at speakers and people telling them to buy the right things or invest in the right places and saying to them, that's crazy because it hasn't worked. And in fact, it doesn't drive right at this minority of people who are making major decisions, fundamental decisions about how we live our lives. And there's disbelief in some ways of listening to people who are saying the same things about how to make things better, when in reality, over 40 years, nothing's gotten better. And by almost every major quality of life indicator, things are worse now than they were before. So I think there's a frustration, and that frustration is opening a window to do things differently.
But that's no guarantee that something's going to happen. And I think, you think back before, in the Depression, before the sit-downs strikes began, even a couple of weeks before the first sit down in Toledo and Flint, and nobody could have predicted that. And before the first, before Rosa Parks sat down, refused to sit down on the bus, and the young African American students sat in at the Woolworth counters, nobody knew that that was going to happen, or that it was going to trigger the kind of response. So in some sense, the time has to be right, and it's very hard to predict that. And all I think that we can do is sow the seeds that we think need sowing, and try to engage more and more people. And when some things happen, not to let the people doing it be isolated and alone. What happened when the first four students in North Carolina sat in at the Woolworth counter and refused to leave, there was enormous pressure by the white economic power structure, the white governing structure in North Carolina, on the old line African-American organizations, on the NACP, on the Urban League, to get those kids out of there. And the organizations responded and went and said, this is not the right time. You're going to cause more harm than good. And fortunately for the civil rights movement, for the country, at that time there was another generation coming up of people in their late 20s, early 30s who had been to the Highlander Center, who knew each other, who had been sort of sowing their own seeds. And they came right to North Carolina to run interference for these kids from the old leadership of the African-American community. And I can see the need for that same thing happening now, because I don't think, you know, when some shit starts to hit some fans in the right framing, in the right direction, the National Environmental and National Labor Organizations are not going to be there. In fact, they're going to be on the other side. And so there needs to be some protection and some cover. And the best cover and protection are going to be this kind of stuff spreading very quickly to other communities. We saw it happen. I mean, I was involved in the anti-nuclear safe energy movement in the 70s. And when we did the first occupations at a nuclear power plant at Seabrook in New Hampshire, first it was 14, and then 100, and a couple of weeks later 140, and then a couple of weeks later got arrested. And then there was a major demonstration of 2,000 people on site, and 1,414 people were arrested and filled the jails, declared bail of solidarity, so we were costing the state of New Hampshire quite a lot of money every day. Within a couple of weeks, this was the Clamshell Alliance, within a couple of weeks, the Abalone Alliance formed in California and the Kudzu Alliance formed in South Carolina, alliances all over the country, and they went right into civil disobedience. So within I'd say, 3 months, 4 months, there were occupations going on at dozens and dozens of nuclear power plant sites around the country. That's how fast it spread. Because the seeds were there, the foundations were there, everybody was in touch with each other, people had experience from other movements, from the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement. So you had experienced leaders, you had people, you know, who knew nonviolent civil disobedience very well and had been preparing, and they were ripe. That kind of seed sowing and foundation laying has to be in place, because the opportunity can come up, and if people aren't ready, it can be lost. I think both the corporate leaders and government leaders are much more prepared today to step in and try to prevent things from happening, and they're much more prepared to be more ruthless than they were, I think, even a generation ago.
A couple of things, particularly apropos the talk of nuclear reactors again.
Nothing ever goes away.
It seems that the federal government has been making every effort to make any type of environmental activism considered terrorism.
Well, Fast Eddie Rendell just signed a law in Pennsylvania a couple of weeks ago doing exactly that. Eco-terrorism is now a felony, and it's defined pretty clearly, and about, I don't know how many states, probably a couple of dozen states have laws of that nature.
First time on Pennsylvania books that eco-terrorism has been used in the statutes. And essentially it's used as a step-up. So not only can you be charged for trespass or other types of civil disobedience, but it adds a new layer of criminal sanction to that underlying violation as eco-terrorism is now defined. And Fast Eddie Rendell, he didn't even look twice at it. He just signed it into law. To me, it says puts a candle or a flashlight on the distinction between Republicans and Democrats, which is zero from this perspective.
Also, there's been the FBI, the federal government, has indicted a slew of people over the last couple of months in from out of actions that they claim took place in the Northwest that they call eco-terrorism, and they're, you know, at least from the Earth First standpoint, what the government has done was do the best that they could to associate a set of people that they knew who've been out front, leaders open, and try to link them to these various so-called crimes and charge them with eco. Well, actually, they use that in the rhetoric, but none of the indictments say terrorism. But the Gonzalez, the Attorney General, actually, when the day they announced the indictments, said he had a press conference as the U.S. Attorney General. And he used all that language of eco-terrorism and everything, but if you go and read the indictments, none of them are about terrorism. They're about doing a particular act. But it's clear that the U.S. government is cracking down, and they're going to try to make an example of these people and try to put them away for a very, very long time, and trying to get them to snitch on each other. I mean, they're trying to break people down. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world and in this country and in the world that the U.S. government is involved in. And for people who are to put the might of the nation behind people trying to save forests and save communities from cyanide mining and save river valleys and save salmon and all that, for the government to be using its clout to go after these people, to try to put people in jail for 50 years for trying to save the ecosystems in the Northwest, is, I think, a perversion of common sense and taxpayer dollars and the law.
What role, from your perspective as an activist, does the media play in all this?
The corporate media? Well, we have a corporate state, and the corporate media helped to maintain the corporate culture. The New York Times Corporation, I've been basically referred to as the cultural police. I mean, they sort of show, even though the Fox Corporation people call the New York Times the liberals and the lefties or whatever they call them, the New York Times is a fine example of an entity that really does police how issues are framed. It validates certain points of view. It ridicules other points of view. It's certainly locked into the culture of endless more. And I don't think that we can rely on the New York Times Corporation to stand up to these state eco-terrorism laws. I think they make sure that as a whole people don't get the kind of information and the kind of perspectives that they need in order to question what's going on.